Well, good morning. Appreciate you being here. I'm your surprise, Bible teacher with a surprise subject, as you say. We'll get started here in just a moment. Zachary, would you mind leading us in a prayer? Get started.
Our good and righteous God and Father in heaven, thankful for this day, thankful for the opportunity that we have together here to study your word together. Ask you to be with us as we study, help us to be attentive, and to glean much from this delving into your word. And we ask that you would be with us as he teaches us and presents the material he's prepared, that he would remember what he's prepared and be able to present it in a clear and easily understood manner. And we thank you most of all for your son and his death on the cross for us. Gives us the hope of being with you in heaven one day. In his name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Zach. Well, as is often the case when I've been asked to fill in or teach, my typical subject matter is basically what I've been studying anyway. Something I've been looking into, and this morning's content is exactly that. Let's see if I can get my papers in order here. So this class will be a little bit unusual, perhaps. So part of what propelled me into this morning's subject, which I'll divulge here in just a moment, is an article that I read, this one right here. I printed part of it off. And this article is a part of a larger study that was actually turned into a book. And the name of the book is You Lost Me. That's the name of the book, You Lost Me. And the study was a Barna research group study over 5 years. And it has to do with, most everyone knows that, and the statistics are fairly well established, that at this time, 2 out of 3 children that are brought up in all forms of Christianity are leaving the faith of their parents between the ages of 15 and, late 20s, let's say 29. So I was, I don't have any statistics for those of us who would be called simply Christians, but this is a study that was conducted over 5 years among many different groups that would, call themselves Christians. So the sort of the long and the short of the 5 year study was that they came up with 6 reasons that sort of seemed to come into focus over the course of interviews with teenagers all the way into young adulthood. So there were, of those who were brought up in some form of Christian teaching and then left it, for whatever reason. So this article that I printed off here is what we'll kind of start off with. And after I give you this list, kind of you can pay attention to it, and if there's something about it that surprises you or something that sparks your, you have some particular thought about it, then I'll open that up for a short discussion about it, if there's any thoughts about it, whether these things seem to be consistent with what you might have thought as it relates to, why there are this sort of exodus from Christian teaching. So here it is. Let's see. That's the cover page. I'll just read this first little caption here that relates to the study itself. says the research project was comprised of 8 national studies, including interviews with teenagers, young adults, parents, youth pastors, senior pastors. The study of young adults focused on those who were regular churchgoers, Christian church, during their teen years and explored their reasons for disconnecting from church life after age 15. No single reason dominated the breakup between church and young adults. Instead, a variety of reasons emerged. Overall, the research uncovered 6 significant themes why nearly 3 out of 5 young Christians, you know, I'm just reading the article here, disconnect either permanently or for an extended period of time from church life after age 15. So that's kind of, that sets up these next 6 reasons. And I'll give you the reasons and then just read maybe a few lines of the paragraph underneath it that explores a little bit more thoroughly the thoughts contained in the little phrase, condensed summary of it. So reason number one is churches seem overprotective. That's the first one. Here's just a few lines about that. A few of the defining characteristics of today's teens and young adults are their unprecedented access to ideas and worldviews, as well as their prodigious consumption of popular culture. As Christians, they express the desire for their faith in Christ to connect to the world they live in. However, much of their experience of Christianity feels stifling, fear-based, and risk-averse. So I'll stop there. That's number one. Churches seem overprotective. Number two, teens and 20-somethings' experience of Christianity is shallow. I certainly don't, by the way, I certainly don't think that that's the case here. Now, that could be the case somewhere, but I certainly don't think it's the case here. We're certainly not shallow here. But this is number two. So a second reason the young people depart church as young adults is that something is lacking in their experience of church. 1/3 said that church is boring. 1/4 of these young adults said that faith is not relevant to my career or interest, or that the Bible is not taught clearly or often enough. So there you have it. Number three. And this one, of course, being the person I am and the interest that I have, perked my interest particularly, and we're going to talk more about number three than the others. Churches come across as antagonistic to science. And this is the caption. I'll just read the whole thing on this one, since we'll be looking into this a little bit more particularly. One of the reasons young adults feel disconnected from church or from faith is the tension they feel between Christianity and science. The most common of the perceptions is Christians are too confident they know all the answers. 3 out of 10 young adults with Christian background feel that churches are out of step with the scientific world we live in. Another 1/4 embrace the perception that Christianity is anti-science, and nearly the same proportion said that they have been turned off by the creation versus evolution debate. Well, that's what turns me on, but apparently it turns other people off. Furthermore, the research shows that many science-minded young Christians are struggling to find ways of staying faithful to their beliefs and to their professional calling in science-related industries. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Number four, young Christians, church experiences related to sexuality are often simplistic and judgmental. And let's see, what one of the significant tensions for many young believers is how to live up to church expectations of chastity and sexual purity in this culture, especially as the age of first marriage is now commonly delayed into the late 20s. I actually think the statistics now show that it's 30 is the typical marriage age. So that's number four. Number five, they wrestle with the exclusive nature of Christianity. Younger Americans have been shaped by a culture that esteems open-mindedness, tolerance, and acceptance. Most young adults want to find areas of common ground with each other, sometimes even if that means glossing over real differences. So they wrestle with the exclusive nature of Christianity. It's number five. And the last one, number six, the church feels unfriendly to those who doubt. Young adults with Christian experience say that the church is not a place that allows them to express doubts. They do not feel safe admitting that sometimes Christianity doesn't make sense to them. So that's all six. I'll just read this one little this one little sentence here that I thought was sort of instructive to all of this. It says, the world for young adults is changing in significant ways, such as their remarkable access to the world and worldviews via technology, their alienation from various institutions, and their skepticism towards external sources of authority, including Christianity and the Bible. So that's it. So does anything there surprise you? Anything there unexpected? Do you see that? Any thoughts about any of those points? Anything come to your mind, or you agree with Rick?
Well, I don't want to be harsh or anything, but in about at least half of the cases, the problem is not with the church, it's with the scriptures and with God. Yeah. And we have young people who are struggling with trying to fit in with their peers and live in the world and taking evolution classes in college and all these things that everybody believes,
right,
and trying to fit that in with their religious faith. And this is the same problem that's been going on,
yes,
since the Bible was written.
Yes.
So in the New Testament, we're supposed to come out of the world and do all these things. So at least in about half of those things, I see,
yeah,
the problem as being not so much a church young people problem as a worldly spiritual,
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good insight. I agree with that.
Yeah, I think you could take that list back 100 years, mm-hmm, and adjust it for that particular time period. You come up with the same thing.
Yeah.
It's not so much, yeah, again, that this environment that we live in today is totally different than it was 100 years ago. So we're still dealing with the same situations.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, obviously, if you go back into the first 100 years of Christianity, or even the letters of to the churches especially I'd say for Corinth, let's say, where you had just gross immorality going on, that there's nothing new under the sun, that humans are all struggling with the same similar things, science, even the Greeks, felt that when Paul came into Athens and the Acropolis and all of that, he was no doubt, many of the philosophers and Greek thinkers there that he was dealing with felt that they were on the cutting edge of science, that what they were thinking was science to them. So, yeah, that's true. Anything else before we move on? Yeah, Dave.
The title we lost me, this generation seems to be more self-centered than most of the ones that I've been aware of in my lifetime.
Yes.
It's all about being.
Yes, that's probably true. And of course, an observation that I have had or made regarding technology and, you know, smartphones. When young people get smartphones, it tends to isolate them from other people. It isolates them from their parents oftentimes. It isolates them from groups, can isolate them from their church family, because it's a thing that seems to, you know, have all the answers in some ways. And I think a lot of young people do go to the internet for answers to, you know, difficult questions. But that isolation, self-isolation is probably part of that self-absorption too. And of course, you know, these are general statements. Not everyone, you know, has the same experience regarding these things. There is another aspect to this, which I've heard a number of times, which and this isn't just for young people, but the largest growing religious, or really, I guess you could say, people that have a worldview of any kind, the largest actually word that would be relevant to those two large groups would be unaffiliated. More and more people are self-identifying as unaffiliated to any religious group, whether Christian or any other. And so that also, which really, when you say unaffiliated, that reminds me of agnosticism, because agnosticism is basically saying, I don't know. You know, I don't have the answers. I don't know what the answers are. I'm just going to kind of remain neutral, you know, in these bigger questions of, you know, why we're here, where the universe comes from, you know, whether there's life after death, you know, who has the answers right and all that. So, yes, Ashley.
I think you said something about not being able to express doubt.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important thing, because people need to feel that there is a safe place to discuss the things that they are wondering about, and not feel that they will be attacked or judged, you know.
Right.
And an understanding that of what God's grace really is. And instead of feeling that they're coming to somebody who's going to judge them, or, you know, or say, oh, I can't believe you'd say that, you know, in a gentle and loving way, say, you know, well, let's look at that together. Let's see what might the Bible say about that. And, you know, instead of like, that's crazy, you ever said that, you know, just being a place that they can talk about that.
Yes.
You know, and I try to do that with my kids, you know, because I want my kids to develop a faith of their own. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that by the time that they grow up, instead of, have I done what my parents told me to do? Have I followed up? I have a sister who fell away, and she has said, well, I just did exactly what I knew mom and dad would want me to do. And now she's making different choices for herself. But I think she never made her faith her own. Mm-hmm. She just, right, you know, went through the motions growing
yes.
up.
Yes. Yeah, that is so important. Gina and I went hiking yesterday with an older friend of ours. I may have mentioned her. Gina has known her since college days. Gina went to Stanley Tech down there in Albemarle for an occupational therapy assistant program that they had. And this woman named Gloria was there, and they got to be friends and got along very well. And basically, Gloria, she was in Winston-Salem, and she moved to Hendersonville mainly because of us and our family, because she didn't really have any family other than a sister that lives way up in Milwaukee. So she moved and bought a little place over in Hendersonville. So we try to see her from time to time. But this actually came up yesterday, because I was sitting there when she came in. We were going to have breakfast together, and we did, and then went hiking, and I was there kind of getting my thoughts together and getting some things. She asked what I was doing, and, you know, I told her, well, I had I'm filling in for our regular preacher tomorrow morning, and trying to get my thoughts together. And she wanted to know more, and I actually read her those six reasons there, and that was the one that she had a comment on. That was that when she grew up in a Catholic school, and she said that it was stifling in the sense that you were not supposed to ask any questions. They were telling you what was, and there was no real space for a class for saying I don't understand this or I have doubts about this. So that, yeah, I appreciate you saying that too. Incidentally, this is some good news. We'll get to you in just a second, Rachel. Gene and I have been wanting to have a Bible study with Gloria for the longest time, really ever since she's been here. And that little, because I was sitting there on the couch looking over these things that I was going to present today, it gave me, and because of her questions, it gave me a little bit of a natural entrance into talking about some things. And I asked her this. I said, you know, Gloria, I had a thought about you some time back that I wanted to ask you. I said, is there any, she's 70, what, 5 years old or something like that, Gina, 74, 75. I said, has there ever been anyone in your life that has simply sat down with you and had a simple Bible study? And she said, no. And I said, well, I would sure like to do that. Would you like to maybe start and maybe meet once a month and for a Bible study? And she said, yeah, I would. So that was good, you know. So I'm very thankful for that opportunity and look forward to opening the scriptures to her. I don't think that she was really, in fact, I'm certain that she was not genuinely indoctrinated into Catholicism, because she really doesn't know that much about it. She had some difficult experiences in their father left them, and she's had a mistrust issue with men, and I've known that for a long time. She trusts me because she knows me very well. She trusts Gina and our family and all, but yeah, those kind of things come up, and of course, early childhood experiences can have so much to do with your attitude towards God and your attitude toward the scriptures and all that kind of thing. Rachel, what did you?
Well, I was just gonna kind of piggyback off of what Ashley said. We see the wisdom literature is full of doubts and questions. And even, you know, we read some of the Psalms, and I read some of them and think, man, these are some harsh words that the psalmist is saying to God.
Right. Yeah.
But what an example of faith, and I mean, it's human nature.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, I know in my own family, you know, you ask the big questions, and sometimes it's, you know, a shock of, well, how could you even doubt?
Right.
You know.
Right.
But we even see that in some of our.
What about Thomas?
Yeah.
You know, Thomas said, "I will not believe unless I see the nail prints in his hands and stick my hand into his side. I will not believe." So no, this is not something new that people have doubted, and people have sometimes a hard time grasping the fullness. And I did, and we all did probably at some point. It takes a lifetime in some ways to grasp the fullness of what is presented in the Bible. And I'm still working on it, and I'm sure you are as well. So I appreciate those comments very much. Well, with that as kind of a context, I want to, move on to some actual, what I thought to do, and this was kind of, has been a little bit of a, obviously evolution, creation has been an interest of mine for a long time. But I also like to think about how things come to be the way they are. And in our generation, and the young people's generation, and our children's generation, like, how is it, how do things change over time? And I appreciate Rick and Gary basically were saying that there's nothing new here, really. But at the same time, I want to, within a lifetime, for example, or 100 years, things can actually change quite a bit within one's own lifetime, even though there are sort of permanent things that go on all the time. And that's sort of the case that I want to make this morning, not in sort of subjective questions of how humans over decades sort of change their thinking in certain ways, but actually more particularly what laws have been instituted through courts that have established certain things and created a context for understanding. And I'm thinking in particular of, you know, public school curriculums, university curriculums, and general teaching like that is something that I have been studying for a little while now. And so what I want to do is start from the 1920s and begin to come forward, and we can kind of think about this together. I don't think any of us were born in the 20s. You weren't, were you, Frank? not quite. So, yeah, my dad was born in 37. But at any rate, let me start with this, because this, in 1925, actually was the first significant law that was enacted that first, that related, and it was kind of a test case in a way, for a law that was enacted in Tennessee. And of course, and I'm sure that many of you, I've known about this for a long time, but I don't remember ever having talked about it specifically. I may have mentioned it in some of my sermons or teaching. But does everybody remember at least the monkey trials or the Scopes trials? Okay, some have, maybe not all have. But that was an interesting case that began a long conversation. And it's not new, and that's true, it's not new. However, it came to the forefront in what was then called the trial of the century, was the Scopes trial, or the monkey trials, as it's come to be known. And this occurred in Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925, and I'll just give you kind of the main facts about it. In 1925, because of there were some school textbooks and curriculums that included a small section introducing the students to Darwinism, the theory of evolution, Tennessee, being a conservative-minded state, and, you know, for the most part, like kind of like the buckle of the Bible Belt, you could say. So very conservatively minded. They did not, the people in Tennessee did not want the teaching of evolution in their public schools in any form. And so they created what was called the Butler Act. And the Butler Act essentially said that it bans the teaching of Darwinism in the curriculum in schools in Tennessee. Well, what happened was that the ACLU, yes, they were existed in the 1920s, the American Civil Liberties Union, which from all my experience with them or knowledge of them seemed to be on the wrong side of every issue. But at any rate, they wanted to create a test case for this Butler Act in Tennessee because they wanted to have it overturned. They did not like it because they wanted the ACLU wanted the teaching of evolution to increase in public schools, not diminish. So the ACLU took out a newspaper ad in Dayton, Tennessee, that basically said, we're looking for a teacher who is teaching in public schools that will stand as a case for having taught evolution, and then we want to prosecute the or defend you. The ACLU wants to, we want to defend you in a court case that would overturn the Butler Act. That's what the thing was about. Well, this young teacher named John Scopes finally emerged and became sort of the person, you know, that this case was going to be built around. Now, John Scopes really, from everything I know about him, he was actually a coach. And once in a while, he filled in for other teachers. And he wasn't actually really sure that he had taught evolution, but he was willing to take up the cause with the ACLU. So that's what the case was about. And so it was called the Trial of the Century. It was in newspapers all over the country. And mainly, it might have remained fairly obscure if it had not been for two individuals that were the lawyers in the case. One, they were both very well-known men of the time. Clarence Darrow was an atheist, a well-known atheist, who prosecuted and defended for the ACLU at the time. And the other one, who was on the side of, you know, the Butler Act, was William Jennings Bryan. And William Jennings Bryan had run for president three times. So he was very well known and very well respected in Tennessee. And so the clash of these two very well known men's and minds are what created a circus atmosphere in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. And what happened in this small town? There was a lot of drama, obviously, in this trial. And it was actually the first trial ever that had been put on live radio across the country. So that was a big thing in itself. People could actually listen to the trial, which was, you know, amazing for 1925. But the outcome was that John Scopes was found guilty of violating the Butler Act and was fined $100, which is not $100 today. I mean, $100 today, maybe not so much, but in 1925, $100 was a lot. But the conviction, though, was later dropped because of a technicality. And nothing really came of it. The Butler Act didn't change at that time. It continued to be in force. So that was the first law that related to the teaching of origins in our country, as far as I know. And now what I want to do is kind of launch forward from there and just tell you about what I have, researched over the last, I don't know, few months or so. Again, I didn't prepare this. Really, I wasn't doing this because I thought I had a class coming up. I was just doing it because I'm interested in the subject. So that was 1925. What happened in 1929 that changed America? It was a stock market crash, right? Wall Street crash. And then what happened in the 30s was what we call the Great Depression, right? So during the 30s, the Great Depression, people were trying to, you know, make ends meet, trying to find food to eat, trying to make things work. They weren't thinking about this subject. That's the point. They had other things to deal with. So this was put on the way back burner for the most part. In the 40s, what was the biggest single collective mind of America's attention on in the 40s. World War II, exactly. Hitler's buildup, through the late 30s and the invasion into Poland, his desire to spread, to conquer other countries and spread Nazism, communism, and all of those kinds of things. So that was a major preoccupation. There wasn't anything else in the news. Nothing else compared to what was going on. And of course, in December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor, and what launched us into the war, and with the Allied forces, and all of the things that could be, historians have talked about ever since, was occupied all of the 40s. They weren't talking about evolution and creation. That was way back there somewhere. However, by the 50s, the soldiers began to come home and reestablish their lives, get married, have children, buy houses, the baby boom, prosperity, rebuilding America, overcoming the ravages of the war effort, and trying to create a country again, once again, in the 50s. And so, as we come forward here, we're getting closer to my lifetime, of course. I was born in 1961, but the American dream was being pursued in the 50s. And there was a time of relative peace. However, in 1957, and this isn't just a history lesson, but this is what happened in 1957 is actually very critical to the subject today. Does anybody remember what happened in 19? It relates to Russia. What happened in 1957? Sputnik. That is correct. What was Sputnik, Earl?
It was Soviet Union launched into outer space, satellites and whatnot.
That's correct. And all of a sudden, Americans looked up into the sky and they could literally see this shining object going around the earth. Oh, man, I got so much yet to say. Don't do that, Ken. Oh, he's our timekeeper over there. But Sputnik, I'll have to kind of cut to the chase on a lot of this, but maybe I'll save some of this for another class sometime. But what Sputnik did to Americans was it made us realize that we were way behind the Russians in our what's now called STEM subjects: science, technology, engineering, math. Because there hadn't been that emphasis on those subjects up to this point. And of course, Dwight D. Eisenhower actually was the one who began to institute laws and encouraged science teaching and curriculums in the school. Now, I'm not blaming him. I'm not trying to demonize Dwight D. Eisenhower, really. But it was a turning point, though, in the curriculums in schools. Now, I'm just going to kind of go through this fairly quickly, just so you can get a sense of what happened from that point forward. So from that point, Darwinism had at least become what people thought of as a scientific view of biology and origins to some extent. And what the first, of course, a whole lot of other things began to happen In 1962, prayer was banned from public schools. In 1963, the Bible was banned as a source book and reference point for public schools. In 1968, there was another act called the Epperson versus Arkansas case, which resulted in the proclamation that no state, district, or school can ban the teaching of evolution. That was 1968. I was 7 years old. In 1970, and I don't think this is a coincidence, in 1973, what happened? What was the big case in 1973? Roe v. Wade. That's right. So the farther we got along in turning the identity of human beings into something other than being made in the image and likeness of God, the more or the less value we had as humans. So, as I said, 1968, teaching of evolution became much more a part of the curriculums. 1973, the Roe v. Wade law was instituted that made child sacrifice, abortions, legal. 1987 was the Edwards versus Aquillard case, which states that a state, district, or school can't require equal time for creationism or creation science. These are all laws that are on the books and that are still in force today. But what one of the things I wanted you to realize was that these things are more, in some ways, more recent than we think. This is not ancient history. These are in my lifetime and in many of your lifetimes that these things are happening. So think in terms of the proverbial frog in the frying pan idea here. That was 1987. 1990 was the Webster versus New Lenox case, which resulted in the proclamation that a teacher cannot teach creationism freelance or on his own. So if I was a teacher, you know, having studied this subject for a long, I could not teach what I know in a public school classroom. I could only teach what I know to be a lie, what I know to be wrong, what I know to be unscientific. I'll just finish up with these last two quickly. Maybe we'll talk about this sometime in the future. In 1990 was the Webster versus New Lenox case, which resulted in that's the one that I just did. 2005, so this is the Tammy Kitzmiller versus Dover Area School District, which says that intelligent design is not science and cannot be adjudged a valid accepted science theory. And incidentally, we don't have time to do all this, but this is the book, y'all can come in, of Pandas and People. I happen to find this somewhere. But this is the book that was going, that the people in Dover wanted to be their textbook for Origins teaching. And I've read the whole thing and it's excellent. And there's no mention of God in the book. It just talks about intelligent design. And that's the conclusion of it. So these are all national laws. I'll leave you with just this one sort of light spot in all of this darkness. And that is in 2008, again, this is fairly recent, and you may not have heard of this, but under Governor Bobby Jindal, the Louisiana Science Education Act went in force, and the ACLU has been fighting it ever since 2008. But what it requires is that whenever origins are taught or spoken of in classrooms, that both creation or intelligent design and evolution have to have equal time. So, you know, who knows what will happen in the future, but I hope that was useful to you and instructive in some ways. So thank you for your good comments. I appreciate the class.